Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoyed the program. Hi there, glad you could join us. Well, tonight on Sunday night, a roundtable look at perhaps the most significant political moment of the next month, the federal budget. In particular, what do our church welfare agencies want from the government and expect from the opposition or perhaps government in waiting? Both sides of politics are retreating from any suggestion of surplus, but neither have moved towards embracing deficit funding in these straitened times. And despite Australia ranking 22 out of 24 OECD nations for taxation, that is, we are amongst the lowest, no one is as yet prepared to talk of raising taxes. It makes for a difficult mix. Not only do our welfare agencies have to deal with real needs of the marginalised in our community, they also have to do a deal with the realities of practical politics in an election year. On Sunday night, it's a great pleasure to welcome into our studios Toby Hall, the Chief Executive Officer of Mission Australia. Toby, good to have you with us.
Good evening. Great to be here.
In our Canberra studios, Casey Chambers and Paul O'Callaghan. Casey Chambers is Executive Director of Anglicare Australia and Paul O'Callaghan from Catholic Social Services. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
And in our Melbourne studios, the man who handles social justice for the Uniting Church in Victoria, Dr. Mark Zunzak. Mark, good to have you with us.
Thanks very much.
Well, could I ask you all first to go through the list? Let's tick off the items that you think do deserve some attention from the public in terms of where the government are going to jump on policy issues when it comes to the coming federal budget. There's been a lot of pressure exerted from the community sector. I know ACOS, the Australian Council of Social Services, have been making noise about it, and others, on the issue of the single mother's benefit. Paul and Casey, you're close to things in Canberra. Are the churches lining up on this one?
Yes, we've been lined up on this for a long time, actually. Both the single parents allowance, but also in regard to the New Start allowance itself, the very low level of that allowance and the extent to which that puts many thousands of Australians into a situation of acute financial stress. And essentially, John, the big challenge of trying to assist as many people as possible to get into employment, because employment has so many benefits, not just the immediate salary, but many other aspects connected to that. And in many ways, by moving this group of single parents back down onto that allowance level, it's created genuine hardship. And I think there's been a strong response, not only from church-based agencies, but much more widely around the country than that. So that's one aspect that we're very keen to see change. But it's one component of, I guess, a broader system of allowances and pensions that really does need to be rectified. And I can talk about that a bit more, but Casey, perhaps.
It's certainly an area of great concern. I mean, it's a shame, to be honest, that we're all sitting around talking about $50 more on Newstart, for example, because really it's talking about, we're sitting around arguing or discussing the size of the elastoplast when we really should be looking at the cause. And certainly Anglicare, along with a lot of the other church and social welfare agencies, believes that really as a society we actually are obligated to more than just money to people who find themselves without a job. We all know that a job is a great way to be connected, to learn things, to have self-esteem, to belong and to contribute. And certainly we need to make sure that every response we give to someone without work is as individual as what's put them out of work in the first place. But as Paul says, that's one of the lists, so we can go through them as we go through the evening.
Well, give me two or three others that you'd you regard as important? New Start and the Single Parents Benefit.
Certainly.
But give us two or three others.
Yeah, look, I don't think any Australian can now walk away from the NDIS, the National Disability Insurance Scheme. Yeah. I hope I'm not going to steal Paul's thunder. We were having a bit of a discussion tonight earlier as to who was going to sort of quote the golden rule first, the do unto others. I think if any of us found ourselves with a disability, we would be glad that the NDIS was now in the minds and imaginations of Australians compared to where we were 5 or 6 years ago. The other areas, I don't think any of us can turn our back morally on the Closing the Gap initiatives. The statistics around outcomes for an Indigenous child born today in Australia are still abysmal, and made more abysmal by the fact that it is so inequitable with a child born to Caucasian Australians. Other areas for us, secure work. So it's not just about getting people into work, it's actually about moving them in the terms of the how inquiry into insecure work from the periphery of work into the core, and therefore embedding them in that ability to contribute. And another area for us that's very hot for us at the moment is secure housing. Anglicare Australia will be launching its annual rental affordability snapshot tomorrow. And I have to say, I've been learning my figures, ready for a 5:30 interview with the ABC tomorrow morning, and they are really quite shocking.
Are you prepared to let us into a preview of those?
I could let you know one figure, because it's just please. So shocking. I can't forget it. We surveyed 56,500 properties across the country over one weekend. 56,414 to be exact. Of those, 13 were affordable for people living on New Start or on Youth Allowance. So you can just imagine the competition, the hopelessness, and
that
the stress
that puts people in.
That was across Australia. That was across the country.
Were any of those in Sydney?
No. The great irony is, as one person said to us, a lot of the affordable properties are in places where there's little work. So if you can afford to live there, there are no jobs. And if there aren't any jobs, you probably can't afford to live there.
Toby Hall, let me bring you into the conversation here. We're looking there, with those figures that Casey has just presented to us, that sounds like Australia 60 or 70 years ago, before governments began to invest in major housing projects, before the slums were torn down and the buildings went up. Now, you or I may not have been around, but we're talking about a profoundly different sort of society than the one we've been used to over the last 30 years, aren't we?
Look, I think we are in one man's slum, which is torn down and rebuilt, becomes another man's slum many years later. And state governments in lots of places across the country have failed the people living in state housing very often. The standard of the housing is appalling. The access to employment, community services is very poor in a number of places. And as Casey quite rightly pointed out, there's very few affordable places. In fact, in Melbourne, where we've done the same sort of studies, the only places that are affordable are right in the urban fringes, and that means there is no access to work or several hours travel to work. In Sydney, a really good example, someone travelling from 2 hours away to come and put parking tickets on cars at Bondi, and you look at that and think, what kind of life is that for someone that they have to travel 4 hours a day to be a parking ticket inspector? And we've created housing which is a distance from work and often is very poor housing, and I think it's an absolutely critical area for the government to focus on. With both parties, we've been really pushing them to say housing has to be dealt with, and we've got a moral dilemma here. All Australians have to turn around and stop saying, I won't have this in my backyard. Everybody wants affordable housing, but not everybody wants it near them. And the fact is, we see time and time again, people oppose pretty sensible housing options which would help lower income people, would help people on New Start benefits. And I think we've all got a responsibility to say, well, actually, maybe we need to change our thinking. Let's get back to the Australia of old that we loved.
Yes, we're not going to get the three-quarter acre block, though, are we? The quarter acre block, right?
Absolutely not. And I think we have to change our thinking and turn around and say, what is the right sort of property that we want to live in? And I think for a lot of people, actually, you're seeing a big move towards apartment living. In the future, more people are going to need one- and two-bedroom houses, particularly as the population ages. We're seeing a demand for that already. So we do need to change our headset around what do we expect. And the fact is, I think the days of the McMansion are over, and we need to start thinking of the mini mansion, and get excited about studio flats and one-bedroom apartments, but those which are affordable and accessible to people across Australia.
Thereupon hangs a number of different arguments. Give me, Toby Hall, just a couple of other priorities that Mission Australia would be looking for out of this federal budget.
Look, I think the key things we're worried about are the welfare system, which has already been addressed, has failed and needs to be completely readdressed. We're also very worried about the state of asylum seekers who've been released into the community on community detention with no access to work, often very poor subsistence funding, which often doesn't even pay for the cost of food. And also we're worried particularly about the cost of childcare, which seems to be spiralling and is causing a lot of pain, particularly in places like Western Sydney, where working mothers are now really struggling to get to work or even pay the childcare bills. So we're quite worried about those. And we've supported the call for a Productivity Commission review there to try and work out how do we make a childcare system that's affordable for everyday mum and dad so they can go to work.
You signalled something there that I wish to come back to in a moment, because I think it does go to the heart of things. You're saying the welfare system has failed. That's a pretty comprehensive claim. We'll hang on to that and come back in a moment. But Mark Zernzak, let me bring you into the conversation here. Toby opened up a couple of areas that are not directly related to welfare services provided by the churches. I've mentioned asylum seekers, and I guess from your perspective, looking after social justice issues for the Uniting Church in Victoria, there's a wider range of issues that cross your horizon as well.
Indeed. Look, I guess top billing, though, because all the things we've talked about so far are spending side, I think we do need to shift to a focus at also looking at revenue, the revenue side, so that we're not constantly looking at this range of needs and these needs having to compete against one another. And we saw that very recently with the government's announcement on the Gonski education, where, you know, in order to provide more funding to schools, there has to be a trimming of funding that was going to universities. So we're constantly juggling because of that. You know, Australia collects currently across all levels of government 26% of gross domestic product. The OECD average is 34%. So there are issues about how much revenue we collect, and it is that dilemma between Australians saying, well, we don't want to pay more tax necessarily at the same time as we want better services. Well, you know, we've got to look at we can't have it both ways in that sense. On the broader priorities, I mean, asylum seekers were raised. There's also mental health issues for us. Looking at the international side, overseas aid is an issue. And again, we're seeing here a government that's probably looking to try and take from the overseas aid budget in order to fund...
Well, it's already done that,
asylum seekers. Well, it is, and the fear is they're going to continue down that path. I think there's a real threat of that. We underfund our diplomatic service as well. So Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade has seen its budget halved in the last decade, is my understanding, down to about $1 billion, while we seem to be very high spenders on the military side of things, $24 billion there. And the Australian government has boasted that we are second out of the, compared to G8 countries, we're second in the world in terms of military spending per capita. And we spend as much on our military as Canada, who have 1.5 times our population. And in fact, we're the largest spender on military in our region. So, you know, there are some interesting questions about
Senator
priorities.
John McCain must have got the message wrong this week in the USA.
Well, indeed. And I think what you're seeing is in these tough times, other governments have been cutting military spending. So we have been following suit to that degree. But our government has been certainly keen to boast that it will, you know, going forward, they would look to increase military spending. And I'm guessing a change in government in September would also mean again, greater priority on that military spending, despite how much of the budget it actually does currently consume.
Paula Callaghan, you've had a chance to listen through to this sort of ever-growing list. What would you put as your top three or four?
Well, I just, if I could, John, follow up. I think Mark has hit on something that's quite pivotal in our national debate about this. If you're a spectator from overseas, you'd think the only way to deal with the fiscal pressures that the government faces is to cut programs across all portfolios. And, you know, those of us who observe the government at work at the moment and in contact with officials and ministers are conscious of huge pressure that they are under, in fact, to try and achieve significant savings. And at the same time, we have not only the OECD, Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development, 2 years ago in its major report on Australia, the Henry Review, the Grattan Institute, most leading economists in the country, who've said that we can't continue to kid ourselves. Expenditure will go up. For example, health expenditure has gone up 74% in real terms in the last 10 years. It's going to continue to go up. Ageing and health-related expenditure is forecast to go up, according to the Intergenerational Report, from 22% in 2015 to 27% in 30 years' time. So there's got to be a reality check here. We must have tax reform. And that reform, we can't just look on the spending side. We have to find, be bold enough on both sides of politics to be able to look at ways of raising revenue, to be able to deal with the changing nature of our society. And that health and ageing aspect is you know, really quite central to all of that. And I think what we're witnessing at the moment is, in many ways, a lack of a disposition to lead with the Australian community from the front in dealing with that. And I think unless there is that kind of courage to address those fundamental tax reform issues, you can't start to see a way of addressing a range of the issues that the community sector is raising. Essentially, what we're talking about are issues that are to do with having not a divided society in which there's an underclass of the kind that we witness in the United States, for example, but one in which the vast bulk of people who are currently out of work, 640,000 or so of them, would actually be assisted with a good investment and support in ways to ensure that the vast majority actually got into employment, because that is a major transformation in its own way. There are a number of these other issues that are there too, in the social programs. But in a sense, unless you get the revenue side of it right, and this is where I think Mark's hit on exactly the right thing, you can't really start to map things out. And you'll notice in the discussion, for example, at the last tax forum, many of the people there were focusing entirely in a business-minded way about what will need to be cut, which programs, and everyone said, well, welfare is obviously a big item, so we'll look at where we can cut welfare, instead of looking at the broader picture. And I think this is really a question of political courage.
We're looking at a situation, and I'd like to break this discussion up into two parts now. I'd like to address this revenue question for the moment and then move on to the question that Toby has raised about whether the system itself does need some structural adjustments within it. But let's first address this revenue question, because this is a question of a national discussion. It seems that we have been conditioned to believe, or our politicians have been conditioned to believe, that the only sort of tax reform you can talk of in public is where taxes are reduced and spending is cut. To talk about tax reform with the subtext of raise taxes seems to be completely off the agenda for both sides. I mean, both sides have now backed away from the surplus rhetoric, but neither of them is going anywhere near the prospect. They're even in denial about the prospect of tax rises. I mean, Tony Abbott is in denial of the over tax rises in conjunction with his payment for parental leave. Hedging it in all sorts of ways at the moment. Is this a flaw in Australian attitudes, as it is amongst our political class? You know, are we just so conditioned, Toby Hall, as a society, to think it's going to get better that we don't dare even contemplate tax increases? In fact, we're hardly done by. We're encouraged to think that we're overtaxed.
Look, I think aspirationally Australians have got a brilliant attitude. I actually think they want to look after people. They want to have good housing. They want to have something like the NDIS. They want the Gonski reforms. We want these good things for our nation. We aspire to them. It's part of who we are. And I think that is a very good thing.
But we also want to improve our own personal lifestyle.
But we want someone else to pay for them. And the fact is that the mantra has been for the last 5 years that you can have everything and no one will be any worse off.
But it's gone on longer than that. It's gone on for the last 15 years.
And I think that's foolish. We've got to turn around and say, as a nation, we need a wake-up call. And the wake-up call is that
if we want these things, someone has to pay. And the fact is, and I think one of the big challenges is there is a significant amount of what I call tax churn. So we pay the government and then we receive back. And there's a lot of people in the middle classes receiving significant amounts of money back from the government. And at some point we've got to turn around and say, if we want these good things, let's put our hand up and pay for them. I think particularly as Christian organisations, we should be encouraging our community to say it is the right thing to do if we care for those who are disadvantaged, to put our hand up and say it's okay to pay more tax to help others. And certainly we believe that there needs to be reform of the taxation system. It's about time the government put their hand up and said, we're going to be brave enough and we're going to get this right for the long term of Australia, because if we don't, we'll just go on a downward spiral, and you can see where that ends up in Europe.
You've got a situation where we've been encouraged to think about tax cuts as the only virtue, because in getting tax cuts, we're also doing something else virtuous, in that we're exerting a little more stick rather than carrot on some sections of the community, and we're also getting rid of a lot of red tape or green tape. These sort of mantras seem to go together. Mark Zernzak, do you see any indication that there is a beginning of a consciousness that those sort of linkages can't go on anymore and they're cheap political rhetoric, or they still carry a lot of weight with Australians?
Look, I think for Australians, we are not as awake to these things as we see overseas. I think other developed countries, certainly in the OECD, so the kind of developed countries, did feel a lot more of the global financial crisis hitting them, and that's caused a lot more attention to the revenue side of the equation as well as the cutting side, because they've been exposed to austerity measures. So I think the people have been a lot more conscious there. But we're certainly there are some positive signs. I mean, globally, we're seeing a lot more attention being paid, for example, to tax dodging and tax evasion and the role tax havens are playing, and the way the very wealthy have been able to dodge tax in some cases. So that's a kind of consciousness raising there. And I think we are starting to see some movements emerging that are really focused on that need to have better societies. I take a lot of heart from, there's a book by British Quaker Richard Murphy, who's also got a business background, called The Courageous State, and he spends at least a third of that book looking at solutions and the need for governments to move back to actually being willing to govern and to regulate for the benefit of the whole community. So I do see some of those sort of movements emerging as positive signs, but perhaps less so here in Australia at this point in time.
I can remember 15 years ago, Kim Beazley daring to suggest when he was in a position of leadership in the Labor Party that we needed as a country to begin to consider the idea of tax rises. Are we yet ready for it, Casey Chambers?
I think we need to be. It's going to be a brave government that does it, especially in an election year. I was smiling to myself earlier. Perhaps, John, you could be brave enough to run a bit of a survey tonight and ask every caller whether they'd be willing to pay more tax. I seem to remember it was done on the ABC TV programme Q&A recently.
It was.
And I think the answer knocked them down. I mean, I'm a child of Thatcher's Britain, and her saying that society, there's no such thing as society, just a collection of individuals, comes back over and over, because I think, obviously, clearly, we come together, we're human beings, we're social animals, we come together to form society, and society is worth far more than the 23 million individuals that make it up. And part of that is because we have shared benefits. As Paul was talking about earlier, the types of things that are going to send the communal bill skywards over the next few years, I think, are good things. They're things like the fact that we are all ageing longer. They're things that like the fact that we are healthier, and therefore the operations that we're having are about keeping us healthier longer. These are things to be celebrating, but they are also things that are going to cost us. But I just think it's ridiculous to think that we can have everything without paying for it. And I think that there are, I think it was Toby earlier, who talked about the inefficiency in some of these tax payments, where we all think that we're either a taxpayer or a welfare recipient. And those of us that are taxpayers pay for these welfare recipients, and yet I don't think I know anybody who isn't eligible for Family Tax Benefit B, for example, who has children. Or the other one that we've talked about from time to time is negative gearing, because, again, coming back to the language of it, negative gearing is often seen to be something that rich investors wisely take. It's not. It's a welfare benefit. It comes from the state to people. And we need to start thinking about all these kind of issues in this same bucket. So I think people are becoming ripe for it, but I think it's going to take some moral leadership.
It's not yet a debate that I think, quite reasonably, you can expect from either side of politics. It's one of those debates that perhaps does need to be generated by the community sector. It's. I mean, to be fair, even in an out year, in a non-election year, it's a debate that requires a bit of not quite a seismic shift, but a fair deal of public education before we're ready for it. Is it something...
John, Paul here again.
Paul.
Just, as I mentioned before... The rest of the world is telling us this. All our leading economists, mainstream institutes, have been telling us the same thing for several years.
And we're even getting our popular economics writers like Ross Gittins beginning to talk about
this
as well.
So there's an aspect there where it seems surreal if you're in the pure political zone, and you know many people would say you're crazy. Why would you even be talking about this? And as Casey says, particularly so close to an election, and I understand that, but. This is one of those things. I think what Toby was saying earlier is absolutely right. It does require a preparedness, in a sense, to step up to a challenge. I don't know whether that's going to happen. But there is one little entry point that the community sector is very aware of that's not exactly related to tax. But in my mind, this sounds a bit crazy, but it takes me back to our penal origins in this country and the role of the state being so much greater than in most Western countries. And that is that we have the most extraordinary range of compliance arrangements on any state and federal funding contracts with community service organisations in this country, to the extent that in a recent survey of the Job Services Australia system, that was estimated to go to the level of taking up roughly 50% of all the time spent by job service providers, 50% of their total time, even if it's a bit less than that, but 50% just dealing with the Department of Employment and Workplace Relations. And if you can imagine that, and all the other agencies that we deal with, we in a sense have a system of compliance which has never really been subjected to the kind of blowtorch of fiscal care and consideration that many other aspects of government activity have. We've just inherited this over the last 200 years one way or the other.
But isn't that an example, and I'm sorry to cut you off, but it's a good example of a sort of duality when it comes to issues like regulation. We say we want to cut red tape, but when it comes to actually making sure social agencies are accountable for what they dole out to the poor or give out to the poor, we want to make them jump through lots and lots and lots of hoops to make sure nobody is getting away with what they shouldn't get away with. I mean, we're very good on cutting regulation at one area, yet another area we want to it down to the minutiae.
I call it covering the bum syndrome. At every level going up to ministers, naturally, they want to be sure that public funds, taxpayers' funds, are appropriately used. But for programs like the Job Services Australia program, which has, in previous manifestations evolved, we've got to a point, in a way, and I'm not just picking that one, there are other programs, where there could be very substantial savings made. And that's really my point, John, that if the same kind of rigour that's been focused on other aspects of government spending were really focused on the way government does its own business in dealing with contracts and other arrangements out there in the community, I think there could be very significant savings made, and that could be applied back into some of those program areas.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio around Australia through Radio Australia, digital radio, and via the web to the world. We're talking about the coming federal budget, particularly welfare agencies and the way welfare should be handled in this very tightly constrained environment. Our guests on Sunday night are Toby Hall of Mission Australia, Casey Chambers of Anglicare, Paul O'Callaghan of Catholic Social Services, and Mark Zernzak from the Uniting Church in Victoria. Toby, I'd like to wipe the conversation now and come to what you provocatively stated earlier, the welfare system in Australia has failed. Tell us what you mean by that.
Look, my belief is that the welfare system was there to help people initially for a short period of time while they're out of work, or to genuinely help those people who had some form of incapacity so they couldn't work. We're now in a situation where we have 1.4 million people receiving either a disability pension or an unemployment benefit, and not many of those people going back into the workforce. And I actually believe we're failing those people and failing our nation unless we genuinely make an attempt to get those people back into the workforce. And I challenge most people to look at their own organisations, including Christian organisations, and say, how many people are genuinely employed who are disabled in your organisation, sitting alongside you in a wheelchair with a profound disability? And the answer too often in Australia is not many. And the fact is we've consigned literally hundreds of thousands of people to receive a benefit, and we think that's okay as a society. And my view and belief is it's not. And the welfare system has encouraged this, that we've said, well, if we just park people on this woeful benefit, everything will be okay. And I don't think it is okay. We need to move to a point where we're saying, how do we encourage participation for people with disabilities, regardless of how severe their disability is? If they're capable of being part of a workforce, why are we not creating a society that allows them to be part of a workforce?
There's a mutual obligation there, isn't it? You may say, well, look, we need to create jobs for these people, but you're also in a situation where many employers would say, well, look, if you want me to take on those people, you've got to give me some money to allow me to provide the facilities for those who need those.
Look, there's often that argument from employers, and I would point to employers overseas, and particularly in America, where there's some excellent examples of a really great retail organisation where, in its logistics business, 40% of the staff are people with disabilities. There's been no increased cost to the organisation. And yes, they've had to make some changes to how they run things, but they haven't run to the government saying, pay everything for us. They've said, actually, we're part of a society and we should look after all of our society. And therefore, if we make a bit of effort to help people with disability, maybe it will help our organisation. And what it's done is giving them better staff retention, solid productivity gains, and people have turned around and said, you know, that's the sort of company that I want to buy from because they're doing the right thing by those who are more disadvantaged. And even if it does cost a little bit more, surely it's the right thing for us to do to say we should have people with disabilities in the workforce, we should be giving homeless people a go, we should be giving young unemployed people a go, and making the investment that's needed, not just sitting back and saying, okay, well, there's a benefit being paid, let's all forget about it and get on with life.
Toby Hall, what you've opened up raises the whole question of carrot and stick, that is, how much of the incentive to get people back in work is disciplined, like cut your benefits, and how much of it is we will pay you X amount to facilitate your getting into the job and allowing a bit on the employer side. That is always the way, it's one of the key things that whenever this debate is raised about encouraging, in quotes, people back into the workforce.
Look, I think one of the key things is making sure there's suitable investment to help people back into the workforce. I would argue under the current system there isn't strong enough investment to assist people back into the workforce, and particularly people with disabilities who've been out of the workforce for a long period of time. There's self-esteem issues that people need support with, there's training issues that people need support with, and there may be equipment they need that's specialist equipment to help them work. That does take investment, but let me give you an example. Our research has shown that for a young unemployed person, it costs about $15,000 if they're highly disadvantaged to get them back into the workforce sustainably. We currently invest less than half of that. Now, when you look at that $15,000, that's the cost of just over 1 year's benefit for that young person. There's not much of an investment, and the amount of savings when they're employed in terms of tax is incredible, but actually for the community, it's a much better thing that they're employed, they're participating, they're part of the community, and they're adding value. And for them as well, from self-esteem, it's much better for them as well. Yes, it sounds a lot, but when you actually put it into perspective, it's a low investment. We've always taken, let's try and provide the cheapest option rather than the right outcome.
Mark Zernzak, you haven't had a word for a while.
Yeah, look, my concern with this is that, and while I absolutely agree that we should be looking not to park people on welfare, it is always the debate then comes back around to how do we get people at the bottom of society to compete more actively and more aggressively with one another for the jobs that are available without really acknowledging that there aren't going to be jobs for everybody. So we end up with this kind of focus on how much carrot and stick do we give to people, and therefore some of these savings that we talk about end up being illusionary because that person gets the job, one person gets the job, another person doesn't get it. But the number of unemployed, unless we're creating more jobs or creating new jobs, it doesn't change that. And, you know, then the other solution that gets thrown up is, oh, well, then it's all down to economic growth. So we just keep growing the economy because that will be the way we generate new jobs. We can look at the US as a model in this. And, you know, what we do see is, yes, they've managed to push more people into employment with a lot more stick being implied. But you can read books like Deer Hunting with Jesus, which is a great little book about what it's like to be in the working class in America, working several jobs and still living in poverty. So, you know, I think I have some concerns about, you know, the only approach being, well, how do we get people to compete more aggressively with one another at the bottom of society for the jobs that are there? And we need to look at what are the kind of solutions that would actually allow everybody who can work to find decent and meaningful work for them.
This debate about carrot and stick undergirds much of welfare policy. We're going to be looking at a change in government. I want to shift gears just a little in this and take it up with Casey and Paul. When you face, as a welfare agency, a possible change of government and a shift in government priorities to where a government says, maybe shifting from motivation through government benefits to motivation on the part of the client or the beneficiary to reform of the welfare services, you've got to trim your sails. You've got to look at how to respond to government. To what extent are you open to actually looking at a different philosophical approach, or are there baselines that you don't cross? You're going to be facing these questions very soon, Casey. Or you could be. You could be.
I think we all know that there will be a different government on the 14th of September. It may be of the same colour, it may be as close, or it may be of a different colour. But of course it will be a new government, whether it's Labour or coalition. Look, I think it's a very poor communicator that doesn't change its message to fit its audience. You communicate by using stories, examples, things that have meaning to the people that are listening to you. However, the message that we're talking about, that we're all talking about tonight, is of such moral importance that we really, there are baselines there we can't cross. We all sort of walk the corridors of Parliament House and we bump into lobbyists. The ones that you see most often are actually from things like the truck industry and the roads lobby groups. Unlike them, and I'm sure they'd say the same, but I feel very strongly that we are lobbying, advocating, calling for things that we just cannot walk away from as a society, that are just simply questions of morality and questions of how we want to live as a society and how we want to live together. So yes, I think you change the message, I think you change the stories, I think you change the examples. I think you understand where that government's coming from, what's led them to their set of beliefs, and then you go back in with your own sets of beliefs.
We're facing a situation where governments are going to be looking at different models. The British model is being looked at, the American model is being looked at. There's a lot of discussion about David Cameron and the big society. Some people are saying this is passing responsibility back to community agencies. Other people are saying, no, what it's doing is just the government is bailing out of things and ultimately leaving people to their own devices. We're looking at contracting increasingly from both sides of politics, the contracting out of welfare services into competitive tendering for welfare services. All of these models are pressing down on church agencies. Is there any right or wrong way through these? Are there any? Do you see a shift fundamentally in priorities, and this is on both sides of politics, away from the notion of the welfare state? And if there is a shift away from that, where is it headed and what are the pitfalls? Let me give you one example, perhaps, contracting out of services. Some people are saying when you force welfare agencies to compete over competitive tendering, what you're doing is actually encouraging a race to the bottom. Paul O'Callaghan.
Well, you've raised quite a few things.
I know. We've only got John, 10 minutes left, Paul. I'm
thrilled about that. If I could just do two of them. The first one is really, I think the key element is, if there's on the coalition side, to really understand that they do have a belief that we need to get as many people as possible into employment. And there is an understanding, I think, that a punitive approach, which has many people, particularly on this exceptionally low New Start allowance level, really under acute financial pressure day to day, week to week, is not likely to lead to the optimal results in terms of getting people to transition into employment. At a logical level, you would say, then, if you really do want to get more of the 245,000 Australians who've been on unemployment benefits for more than 2 years, if you want to get most of those people actually into the workforce, independent, out of the welfare system and so on, then you really want to harness the very considerable talents of people who are around our job services system, who do know how to assist people with multiple challenges, not just disability, although there are many of those, but people with many other significant disadvantages. And I guess the smart answer, if you're a government coming into power, is to say, well, we do have as a high priority, including in terms of getting labour force participation levels up, we have as a priority to invest in this venture. And yes, it does cost. It costs more than is being spent now. But what do we have now? We have essentially a medium level of program where those who don't have major barriers or significant disadvantages do find employment, but most of those who don't, who do have major barriers, don't. And when it comes back to your question about the punitive approach, a very significant number, something like 60 to 70% of those in that category, actually end up dropping out of the whole system. They disappear in a way because they are not, either through a sense of hopelessness or it's not going anywhere for them, they disappear from the system. That is not good for our community. So I think from a coalition perspective, at least this is the way I'm communicating about it, that an investment, a better investment, using all the skills and experience that are there. We have no shortage of good people in Australia who know how to do this work to assist folks, that we can actually achieve a really substantial improvement in that area.
You're talking about really close case management then, taking case management
that's right,
seriously.
Case management, particularly for people who have significant disadvantages, including in the disability area. We're really underselling there. And, you know, there's been plenty of research into this. It's not unknown. It's again, you know, the irony that we have this huge compliance system which could offer up major savings to contribute to this. But what we certainly need is a better investment.
One of the aspects that the government have proposed for us, or governments have proposed of both sides, and that is competitive tendering. Over the years, Mark Zernzak, this has come in for some criticism. I've outlined one of the criticisms, that it's a race for the bottom. What do you think of competitive tendering at welfare agencies?
Look, I do have concerns, and I think it's a debate our community should have about the retreat of government in providing services and privatising them effectively, whether that's out to the not-for-profit sector or the for-profit sector. And it is a fraught area. It's a question of whether you end up trying to get the service more cheaply by cutting wages, basically. You also end up in this situation where you often have to very deeply specify what are the performance indicators of delivering the service, depending on the organisation taking it. So obviously if you've got a very committed organisation to the clients that they're servicing, obviously that's less of a problem. But if you have an agency or an organisation that's looking, you know, looking at the economics of it, well, then you might need to more tightly specify what needs to be delivered. So I think this whole move towards privatising and the big society idea in the UK is a fraught area. I mean, my understanding of what's happened in the UK is we have seen a lot of privatisation, a lot of large corporates moving in, and job cuts from the public sector. So, you know, we're talking about unemployment here, and we end up chopping more jobs out of the community altogether in this race to privatise.
We've got only three or four minutes left, and I'd like to do the rounds again and just get to a final point with this discussion. And I'll start with you, Casey. We're now looking at just a couple of weeks. Wayne Swan faces some very difficult challenges. We're not going to see the broad philosophical changes, but perhaps we will see some immediate change. So what would you look for in the benchmarks leading up to budget night? When if you want to give Wayne Swan a tick, what will it be over?
It does sadden me to prioritise the elastoplast measure, the new start and the benefits, but I really don't think we can do anything but that. Research that we commissioned NatSem to do for us as church providers found that people on New Start in particular were spending 122% of their weekly budget. What this means is that from the very first moment someone falls into Australia's safety net, they're having to beg, borrow, steal, pawn and do without. And that's just, you know, we're actually, that's where the welfare state is failing as well. People are not able to look for work. We found they couldn't afford things like telephones, clothing for interviews, those kind of things. So it's actually shooting itself in the foot. Yes,
they can't even get to the first rung on the ladder. Toby Hall, your first priority.
Look, I agree with Casey. I think that if Wayne Swan seriously can't do something for single parents and people on New Start allowance, I really question where Labor is standing in terms of its traditional constituency. So I think something needs to be done there. Equally, it needs to be bold enough to turn around and say, I'll think about increasing taxes and also a full review of the welfare system.
Mark Zernzak?
Look, I'd agree there. But also the National Disability Insurance Scheme, I think, needs to be a key priority.
Both sides need to commit to that?
Absolutely.
Mm. And Paul O'Callaghan, the last word from you.
I think the major review of the allowances and pension system is something that's way overdue, and I think both sides of politics know that, but we do need to see something happen on that. I'd just say finally that small, isolated rural communities need better access to social support services. Through our network, we've found that there's an acute need there, and for a very small investment, tiny investment, in fact, there could be quite a substantial improvement.
On ABC Radio around Australia and through Radio Australia, you've been listening to Sunday Night, our issue this evening, Budget Priorities, the Church Welfare Perspective. But thank you so much to our guests this evening, Toby Hall of Mission Australia, Casey Chambers of Anglicare, Paul O'Callaghan of Catholic Social Services, and Mark Zernzak of the Uniting Church in Victoria. Thank you so much, all of you, for participating in this discussion on Sunday night.
Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Thank you, John.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. You can download your favourite Sunday night interviews from our website at abc.net.au/sundaynights with an S. Thank you for listening.